I'm Major General Retired Clay Hutmacher, the President and CEO of the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Soft Spoken with Quiet Professionals. Today, we're spending some time with Captain Retired Derek Herrera. Derek is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and served as a Marine Infantry and Special Operations Officer for 8 years. Derek was medically retired from the Marine Corps in 2014 after injuries sustained during a combat operation in Helmand, Afghanistan in 2012. His personal decorations include the Purple Heart, Combat Action Ribbon, Bronze Star with Combat Distinguishing Device, Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal, and Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal. Since his injury, Derek has earned an MBA from the UCLA Anderson School of Management and founded a medical device company, Spinal Singularity. Spinal Singularity's mission is to develop devices that improve the quality of life for people with spinal injuries. He also serves as the president of the board for the Marine Raider Foundation, chairman of the board for MVP Vets, and Southwest regional board member for the American Technion Society. Derek, welcome. Thanks for spending some time with us today and talking about your journey as an officer and afterwards.
Thanks for having me, Clay. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to help share the great work that Special Operations Warrior Foundation has done and how it's helped me. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks very much. So if you don't mind, would you start and just sort of tell us, a little background about yourself and, what brought you to the Naval Academy? I'm not an academy guy, so, there's no scar tissue with me. I mean, if our chairman of the board is a West Point guy, so I'm sure he would want to know why you took the road to, the road less traveled, according to his opinion. I'm kidding. But just tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to the service.
For sure. So the military was what I would call my family business. Both of my grandfathers were enlisted in the Air Force for 25 and 29 years. My father served as an Air Force officer and was an Air Force Academy grad. He served for over 20 years on active duty and then up to 30 years total with reserve time as well. And so was always exposed to the military from a very young age. And no one had pushed me in that direction, but I was just aware of it. And it was tangible and meaningful to me. And so I'd always considered it. And as I was going through middle school and high school, started to learn more. I actually lived with my father at the Air Force Academy when he was stationed there for 2 years during middle school, which was a great experience. I got to see a lot of things they did firsthand. And the opportunity arose when I was in high school, as I was applying to different colleges and universities to attend the Naval Academy. And so at that time, I was living in Dover, Delaware, and it was close to home. I also was trying to play lacrosse competitively and had a relationship with the coach there. And so once I had received notice that I was accepted to the Naval Academy, I actually stopped applying to the Air Force Academy and stopped applying to West Point as well, because I knew that was where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And at that time too, I also, despite my father being a pilot and my grandfather's being in the Air Force, had this fascination with special operations, and I knew that I wanted to either be a Navy SEAL or some type of special operator.
Great. So, I guess that was obviously the driver for you when you opted out of a Navy to Marine Corps. What instead of going Navy SEAL, I'm just curious what drove you to Marine Corps. Well, it must have been the fantastic haircuts that Marines sport all over the world.
I wish that was the case. Honestly, up until my senior year, I was trying to be a Navy SEAL. And due to, a lack of maturity, frankly, on my part, I didn't get selected. It was incredibly competitive, and the men that were selected to go on and serve in those roles are phenomenal men who I'm still friends with a lot today. But at that time, I was still kind of a aggressive, young, somewhat arrogant, overconfident young man. And that was absolutely not what they were looking for, I found out. And so it was a very humbling experience not to be selected. But it was also one of the formative experiences of my young adult life. And I'm really happy that it happened that way and that I learned that lesson before I got to the operating forces, because it made me grow up. It humbled me. And, you know, I ended up going into a line of work that I owe everything to with the Marine Corps. And so couldn't have happened in a better way, even though at that time it was pretty devastating. But it was one of those things that was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me. And I'm incredibly grateful and glad that the system and the process worked the way that it did, because, you know, it changed who I was. And so when I entered the Marine Corps, I was incredibly excited. I was very fortunate to even get a slot because it was also competitive to become a Marine Corps officer. And then I did, and just, you know, went 100%, put myself 100% into becoming the best Marine officer that I could possibly be. And, you know, and that's how I started my career after I graduated and was commissioned in 2006.
Okay, excellent. So picking that up there, I mean, that's interesting. I did not realize that it was that competitive at the Naval Academy to get into the SEAL program. Okay, now you're in the Marine Corps. And by the way, for everyone listening, I spent 6.5 years in the Marine Corps starting as a private, as an Amtraker, from 78 to 84 before I got picked up for Army Flight School. So I do have an understanding of the Marine Corps. That's why I feel empowered to make fun of the haircuts, right? So, but as a Marine, you know, can you just talk about your experiences a bit as an infantry officer, and then what drove you? I think you were, you know, was sort of obviously leaning towards MARSOC or Marine Special Ops Command when you came in, but just sort of that process and, you know, the decision points you had along the way.
Yeah. So when I was commissioned in 2006, so obviously being at the Naval Academy from 2002 to 2006, I witnessed, you know, firsthand the leadership that, you know, the upperclassmen who are graduating were going to display for, you know, as they went forward in combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, in 2002, it was after September 11th, you know, I had joined, but I wasn't initially there for all of the patriotic and, you know, selfless reasons. But over time, I became more and more passionate about the mission that we were called to perform. Mm-hmm. And so all I wanted to do was to lead men and women in combat and serve my country in that manner while I could. And so in 2006, I was very fortunate to become a Marine officer. And then even as a Marine officer, we all go to the basic school for 6 months and there's another selection. So when you enter the basic school, you're only designated as a ground or an air officer. And so that's competitive. At that time, it was competitive as well to become an infantry officer. So from day one, you know, we're all putting forth 100% effort all of the time to do everything we can to get the job we want, right? And so was very fortunate to perform well and end up, you know, in, you know, the top third of the class at the basic school, and was fortunate to become an infantry officer and then go on to infantry training. And so at that time, you know, we were all very united in the mission that we were looking to accomplish as young officers and lieutenants. And so all we cared about was creating functional and high-performing teams and going forward to support our nation and do what was asked of us. And so I found myself completing the training course, completing infantry officer's course, which is a 3-month infantry training course for second lieutenants and, you know, and junior officers at Quantico, Virginia, and finished that in 2007, and then was assigned to my first unit, which was 1st Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And so showed up there as a young officer, took command of a platoon, become a rifle platoon commander right away. And we began preparing for our first deployment, which we found out shortly after we arrived to the battalion would be to Iraq in 2008.
Okay. My memory serves me correctly, I think 1-9, wasn't there, weren't they called the Walking Dead from Vietnam? Is that right? Yeah, they were. When I did a tour on Okinawa, and at the time 1-9 was a Camp Hansen. I was up at Camp Schwab, just a little bit north of there. That's where they were permanently stationed. So yeah, I remember 1-9 very well. How about going into MARSOC? I know, again, was that part of the plan, or was there, were they doing active recruiting, you know, of Marine infantry officers?
Somewhat. So at that point, you know, I didn't even think about, I wasn't thinking about recon or MARSOC. I thought about it loosely, but ultimately all we cared about, most of us, almost all of us were cut from the same cloth in our infantry officers course. And, you know, and there was probably, I think, 60 graduates or so at that time, but everybody just wanted to lead high performing teams in combat. And so whether that was in the infantry, where we all started, then great. And then the opportunities beyond that, the way the Marine Corps typically fulfills those positions are for more senior officers, so either first lieutenants or captains, whether it's in the reconnaissance community or in MARSOC. And at that time, in 2006, was when MARSOC was created. And so first and fourth reconnaissance companies became the Marine Special Operations Command overnight with an unfurling of the colors at that time, which took a long time and the Marine Corps held out on for a long time until there was a order, you know, an executive order that was signed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld at that time. And so until then, you know, although there were reconnaissance units in the Marine Corps, which were very specialized by law and by congressional mandate and just titles and authorities, there were no Marine special operations units. You know, there was no Marines units permanently assigned to Special Operations Command, which means inherently, if you're not a part of Special Operations Command, you're not a special operator. And so the timing worked out very well. I was very fortunate. So I completed deployment to Iraq in 2008. And then at that time had such a phenomenal experience that they were actually doing the assessment and selection process for MARSOC. And so I signed up and was fortunate to get a slot to go to the selection process, which is very similar to the Army selection process. It's a short 3-week portion of assessment and selection where at the end of that 3 weeks, the people that are selected, you know, to move forward with training to become a special operator. And so at that time, I went through selection in 2009 after I'd gotten back from deployment, my first deployment, and then was selected. Actually, correct me, it was 2008. But after I'd been selected at the end of that, I knew that was where I wanted to be and the people I wanted to work with. And, you know, I didn't know much about the missions that they were tasked or assigned with, but I knew that those type of individuals, if I was going to choose to stay in the Marine Corps and continue to serve as an officer, that was where I wanted to be because of the people that I would be with and working with, because it was the most professional, most proficient, the most motivated Marines that I'd ever been exposed to in that setting. So that's why I chose to continue to move forward and do that. But at that time, the requirement for the Marine Corps was that you would have to complete a minimum of 2 deployments before you could get orders to the Special Operations Command. And so I was selected, but then I had to go back onto another deployment with 1-9. And so I was a company executive officer where I deployed on the Marine Expeditionary Unit, which was, you know, Marines on ships floating around, you know, the ocean, and had a great experience. And we went, you know, all across, you know, the Caribbean, the Atlantic, into the Middle East, doing non-combat operations. And so I had a phenomenal experience doing that, but was very excited and ready to begin the next chapter after that deployment and move forward. And so began special operations training in the fall of 2010, shortly after I'd gotten back from that second deployment.
Great, great. I think was General Halick the CG at the time when you were there?
He was just leaving, and then we had a general, General Lefebvre, who, linebacker, who was his call sign, and was awesome, awesome guy. And so he was in charge of the Marine Special Operations Command units at that time.
Yeah, okay. So if you don't mind, I'd like to do is transition a little bit to Afghanistan in 2012, when you were wounded. Can you talk about the broader context of what you were doing in Helmand, and then maybe get a little more micro and about that particular operation where you were shot?
Yeah. So after I completed training for the individual training course, which is the pipeline course for MARSOC, for special operators, critical skills operators, and raiders, finished that course in the summer of 2011 and showed up to 1st Marine Raider Battalion here in Southern California at Camp Pendleton. Shortly after I arrived here, was assigned to a team with Charlie Company, where I was a team commander and in charge of the special operations team as we were preparing for deployment. And so we deployed in May of 2012 to the Helmand province of Afghanistan. And our mission that we were conducting was a mission called Village Stability Operations. And the Village Stability Operations program was very similar to what's been done in the past with other counterinsurgency campaigns and everything from Vietnam to even long before that. But basically, we would take a small special operations team of highly skilled Marines and sailors and embed ourselves into a local village that was strategically selected because of the implications for the overall order of battle and the operational plan and the campaign plan. And so for us, we were manning a small village stability platform, which is what we call that site, in a very rural, undeveloped area of Afghanistan that was at very high risk of Taliban influence because of the growth of poppy in the region. And so in this area, if you imagine, you know, no electricity, no running water, we're in between two canals. The only thing that's happening there is the growth of poppy and farming, right? And so the people there who were, you know, for the most part, pretty normal, generally, you know, hardworking farmers trying to survive these, you know, conflicts, were kind of put in the middle. And our job was to be there to enable them and set the conditions for success for them to be able to, you know, to not be influenced by the Taliban, right? And so unfortunately at that time, you know, the Taliban had a very strong influence over them because they were the ones paying them to grow this crop. And so if that's your boss, and the tactics they were using were very ruthless, obviously, to maintain that type of order and control in the region, it was a very complex and dynamic mission that we were tasked with achieving. We had three major lines of effort in the village stability, you know, program, the manual, which was one, to establish security, two, to try to revive economic development, and then three, to link the political governance from the local and provincial level to, you know, to the national level to try to create some semblance of democracy. And without security, you can't really move on to the other two. And so this area we'd been in had been a very kinetic region, a lot of enemy activity. Almost, if you imagine, literally us on one side of the river and bad guys on the other. You know, that's pretty much what it was. Across the river, maybe 2 to 3 miles away, was complete Taliban control for neighborhoods and villages there. And so as we were set in this region to try to accomplish this mission, we'd have to fend off enemy attacks on a daily basis. We'd have to try to navigate through, you know, minefields and, you know, IED laden areas just to get to talk to people in the zone and to get to know them and try to accomplish this mission. And it was a very dynamic environment. And so that was kind of what we were tasked with doing. And we began to have great success. And so because of the initiative and the knowledge and the professionals of our team and also the foundation that was set from the teams that were there previously, we fell in on a decent situation, one that we thought was supportable and achievable for the most part. And so, you know, we began to start to push out this, you know, security bubble and to continue to revive, you know, development in the area. And the way that looked was because of the numerous amount of IEDs in the area was we would be very cautious and meticulous and thoughtful in the way that we would mitigate that threat. And so the enemy tactic at that time was if you walked around anywhere in this area during the daytime, they would have enemy fighters positioned all throughout the fields and, you know, the area to fire at you, not with the intent of starting a firefight, but with the intent of driving you towards these IEDs. So when you get shot at, you seek cover, and next to you, where you run to, is a victim operated IED that blows up when you take it. You know, and that was the DTPs that they would typically follow. And so because of that, we would move at night under the cover of darkness, where we could process that threat in a meticulous and thoughtful manner. So we didn't really move during the day. We'd operate at night and walk around through these fields, navigating through the IED threat, and then spend a day with locals, spend a day here, spend a day there in these compounds, getting to know people. And so during that time, we were engaged a lot, and we, you know, while we were in these compounds, we would end up fighting and, you know, would set ambushes for enemy fighters as well, and began to have some success in that regard. And so I found myself on June 14th, 2012, the day that I got injured, leading a patrol to a compound slightly further than we had gone from our base, which we thought was selected strategically, again, because of the enemy activity in the area. And so everything went well during the infill of that mission. We got into that compound, began to discuss things with the people that were living in that compound and set up. And then shortly after sunrise, as was pretty typical, we encountered enemy activity and there was a firefight. And so limited engagement may have lasted, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes. We had a few Marines on the rooftop of this compound, and then the rest of our Marines were inside this courtyard of the walls of this compound. And so in Afghanistan, the construction had, you know, it was mud walls that were very thick. And the good part of this was they would offer you protection from bullets and any sort of enemy incoming fire, but it would also decrease the visibility and the awareness that you have because you can't see through them, obviously. So because of that, we would have a few Marines on the rooftop of these compounds where they could see, but they were also exposed. And so maybe, I don't know, a few short time after that initial engagement, as I've made the radio call to our task force at that time to let them know what's going on, I decided to switch out and with my assistant patrol leader at that time and go onto the rooftop so I could observe what was happening and see the enemy activity. And so shortly after that, you know, maybe 15 minutes or so, we were engaged by an enemy fighter who had, you know, come from a direction where we hadn't seen previously. And, you know, three of us were on the rooftop, two of my sergeants, Rick and Dave and myself were on the rooftop and just felt an immediate pain and stinging sensation in my back and was slumped over, took quick stock of myself, realized that nothing below my chest was working and that I was paralyzed. Got on the radio, called my teammates down in the, you know, in the compound, let them know that I'd been shot. And at that time that Rick had been shot too. As I looked at him, he had been shot through the neck, you know, in one side, not the other. And so Ricky and I were on the rooftop, immediately began to try to triage myself, try to assess the situation, see what was happening. But that was the beginning of a coordinated enemy attack. And as incoming fire was still occurring, you know, just laid low until my team could to take action to get us off that rooftop. And so immediately the team sprung into action. We had a small force there. It was only 10 Americans total, 10 of our Afghan partners. And so two of us were now critically wounded and in, you know, severe danger and may not survive. And the other team members came together, repelled the enemy attack, got us off the rooftop, stabilized us, and got us out of that situation. And so that was a day that changed my life forever. It was a day that, you know, since that day, I've been paralyzed from the chest down. And it's what I think was the best and worst day of my life. And I say that because, you know, it was the worst day of my life because the job that I had loved and committed my life to doing was no longer a job that I could continue to do and change the course of my life significantly. But it was also the best day of my life as a leader because a team that I was fortunate to lead in combat was able to accomplish what I think was a performance that's unmatched or that's as flawless in execution and teamwork and all the ideals that as a leader you want in a team. And, you know, and that for me was the most rewarding single event that I will ever have as a leader, you know, was to be able to witness these other eight Americans who I'd had the fortunate pleasure of leading and working with operate in a manner that, you know, was selfless, you know, at every step of the way, professional and proficient and heroic. You know, there's no other better word for it than heroic. And so those men, you know, up until the point where They got us on the helicopter to get out of there, continued to risk their lives. And then even after that, you know, stayed there to fight for another 18 hours until it was dark again and they could be extracted. And so for me, you know, that was the day I was injured, June 14th, 2012. And it was a day that changed my life and, you know, a lot of, you know, challenging ways and presented me with a new set of challenges, but also was one of the best days of my life.
Wow, that's a very compelling story. And I certainly, your optimism in the face of great adversity is very compelling and inspiring, Derek. And I'm curious, what happened with Rick?
So Ricky actually is doing very well. So he was shot through the neck. It missed pretty much everything that was important in his body. And so, you know, our medic, who's an amazing medic, actually had him, you know, kind of mumbling and talking and blinking and stabilizing before he got in the helicopter. And then afterwards he made a full recovery for the most part. So I believe he still, you know, deals with some, you know, nerve damage and things, but he's gotten into bodybuilding. He's graduated from college. He's just had a kid, has been married and has his first child. And so Rick is doing very well. He's actually amazing. And I still see him a lot. He still lives in Southern California here. And so we hang out from time to time. And he's doing great.
Wow, that's great to hear. So, you know, you've been injured here. And obviously I read your bio and both you started your own company, Spinal Singularity, your services, the president of the Marine Raider Foundation, chairman of the board for MPB Vets, and then Southwest regional board member of American Technion Society. So, I mean, you're continuing to serve, obviously, in a different capacity. Can you just talk us through that whole journey of recovery and what it's meant to you?
Yeah, the recovery process had a lot of ups and downs. And you know, as I was coming to terms with the reality of the situation that I was facing, which was that I would be, you know, permanently affected by this injury, it was a bit of a tough pill to swallow, right? It was a challenge and a lot of ups and downs. Fortunately, was supported by some amazing people like my wife and my family, my teammates, my unit, and so many other people as well. So many, you know, phenomenal people, but then also organizations like Special Operations Warrior Foundation, the Marine Raider Foundation, and other veteran service organizations who can step in and fill these needs that are unmet by government programs. And so what I tell people, you know, as I was recovering is the government was phenomenal, right? They provided me with so many benefits and things that were able to help me rehabilitate and recover. But every recovery is unique and, you know, and there's unmet needs with every single person who deals with these types of traumatic injuries and recovery processes. And so the best thing that I could do through my recovery was going back to work and doing something meaningful. And so for a while, you know, I've always been in a team, right? Always doing things with a mission, a purpose, a sense of self and identity and goals. And during the first 6 months after I'd been injured, when I went to Bethesda and then down to Tampa, Florida to the VA hospital there at the spinal cord injury unit, I was isolated. And so my wife was there, but there was no one else from my unit there and it became pretty lonely. And so we made the decision to try to get back to work and get back to California as quickly as possible. And because of the support I had from my command and a very fortunate, you know, environment with things like a wheelchair accessible building, you know, I went back to work as an assistant operations officer in our you know, operations section of the battalion. And did that for another couple of years, which was incredibly important in my recovery just because I wanted to be with the people that I was working with, doing things that were important and have, you know, have a purpose, right? And so I did that for a while. And as I was figuring out my next moves, went back to business school part-time. And as I did that, asked myself a question. The question I asked was, of all the things that I could do, is there any one thing that only I can do in the world? And what I came up with was that I have this injury. I'm faced with a lot of problems, but my entire life I've been a problem solver, an innovator, and, you know, try to create solutions. And so began to come up with this idea, which became Spinal Singularity, the company that I founded. And ultimately it was just that I have this injury, so I know what these problems are firsthand, and I can help design solutions that may help people just like me, and to build a business around that. And so that's how Spinal Singularity was founded. And so I left the military as medically retired in 2014 and graduated from business school in 2015. And have been running this company, trying to build it ever since and try to get, you know, products on the market that can help people just like me. And so that's what I've been doing with Spinal Singularity, and then all of the other nonprofit work that I've been involved with Marine Raider Foundation, MVP Vets, and American Technion Society. It's just other opportunities that I have to give back and to try to help people that have helped me along the way. And so Marine Raider Foundation was there for me every step of the way to support any of the needs that I had. And so after I had retired, I was fortunate to become a board member and serve there. MVP Vets is a transition assistance program for veterans to find employment in the medical device and life science industry. And so I've recently become involved with them because I've, you know, through my network with Spinal Singularity, have been fortunate to meet so many people in the medical device industry. And then American Technion Society is an interesting organization as well, and became affiliated with them because one of the inventions that came out of this university, the Technion University in Israel, is an exoskeleton device that enables people who are paralyzed to stand and walk again. And so as I was the first person in America to be able to use this device and to own one after they obtained FDA clearance, became connected with them and passionate about supporting their efforts as well. So trying to take every day as an opportunity to go forward and live a life that, you know, that has impact and meaning and purpose. And more than anything, probably at the lowest of lows, the things that had helped me through those situations was understanding that I have the opportunity every day to go forward and make a difference. And so those opportunities are opportunities that a lot of the people that I serve with don't have because they were unfortunately killed in action. And so, you know, shortly after I was injured, three other Marines in our company, not in my team, but my company, were killed. Captain Matthew Minuki and Gunnery Sergeant Ryan Jeske and Staff Sergeant Sky Moat, who were all killed on August 10th, you know, maybe 2 months after I was injured, less than 2 months after I was injured. And so dealing with that and their memories and their legacies, you know, thinking about all the things that I have that they don't, really puts it into perspective for me every day, knowing that I can go forward and do things and that any one of those guys would be happy to be in my position. You know, they'd be, you know, rolling around, killing it. You know, they'd be doing awesome work. And so for me, I have to take advantage of every day to move forward and live my life in a way with make them proud and honor their legacies. And so, so that's the organizations I've been working with recently. And fortunately, due to so many organizations like Raider Foundation, Special Operations Warrior Foundation, and so many other nonprofit organizations that have helped me along the way, I'm able to accomplish some of the things that I have been and continue to go out and try to pursue on a daily basis.
Wow, Derek. I mean, it certainly does put things in perspective, you know, hearing your story and your continued commitment to serving others, you know, both through all these nonprofits and then both through your business as well. And of course, the exoskeleton, before we started this discussion for the audience, Derek and I found out we have a common friend with Gary Linfoot, a pilot that flew with me that was severely injured in an aircraft crash on May 30th, 2008 in Salman Pak down by Baghdad. When his AH-6 had a catastrophic mechanical failure. And he has started with the iBot, which is, I'm sure you're aware of it, Derek, the mobile, a very highly mobile, it doesn't do it justice to call it a wheelchair, but it's a mobility device. And then the exoskeleton. I'm very impressed with that technology and just, you know, what you both are doing is advancing that technology. You know, because it'll continue to get better, you know, it'll continue to develop because of your experiences and what you're doing and what, and so I did not realize that American Technion Society, that's what it was. I didn't realize that I was associated with the exoskeleton. So my hat's off to you for that. I know what a positive impact. And again, just to diverge for a second, when with Gary Linfoot, when his daughter got married, that exoskeleton allowed him to walk his daughter down the aisle. And, you know, I have pictures of it on my phone, and he sent them to me, and I was fortunate enough to be Gary's commander. And so I think you guys are doing the Lord's work here, and I couldn't be more thankful for that. Well, listen, this has been great. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything you'd like to share before we sign off? But for me personally, Derek, I'm very grateful that you're spending this time with us, and I'm very inspired by hearing your continued optimism and willingness to serve others. It certainly is inspiring me. So over to you, sir.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for what you continue to do. And so for anybody out there who's listening and interested in learning more, the mission that Special Operations Warrior Foundation is out pursuing, and that Marine Raider Foundation, all these organizations go out to pursue, I encourage you to learn more, because it's a noble cause and the need is there. And so if you're in a position to learn more or share or support, you can find that on the website, on the Special Operations Warrior Foundation website, or Marine Raider Foundation website, or any veteran service organization you choose. Because the reality is men and women from our nation continue to go forward and serve every day across the globe. And organizations like this will step up to fill the need and need your support to enable us to go forward and continue to accomplish these missions and support these people who have sacrificed so much on behalf of our nation. And so appreciate you listening, appreciate you learning, and just hope that you'll learn more and make an informed decision to support in any way that you can, whether it's time, talent, treasure, just getting involved or volunteering for any of these organizations that you care about and become passionate about.
Derek, thanks again. Time very well spent, and I wish you well, and I really appreciate you spending time with us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much, Clay.